these body standards, they have their roots in white supremacy, in the patriarchy. There is so much money invested in making sure we all continue to feel like we are not enough, because there is no money in people liking how they look and just leaving it alone.
Welcome to Shoulders Down, a podcast for truth seekers who want to heal their relationships with food and body. I'm your host, Leah Kern, and I'm an anti-diet dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and fellow truth seeker with personal experience navigating disordered eating. In this podcast, you'll learn to harness your body's innate wisdom to govern not just how you eat, but also how you live. It's my mission to help you heal your relationship with food and body so you can live your most aligned and fulfilling life. Welcome, and I'm so glad that you're here. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Shoulders Down. Today's guest is Debbie Serafim, who I got connected with because she wrote a children's book about body acceptance, and she reached out when she was in the process of advertising the book, and I loved the book. I loved the message. It brought chills to my body. And so I wanted to have her on the show to share a little bit more about her story and her work with you here. Before we dive into Debbie's episode, I want to give a trigger warning. I always feel like when I'm giving trigger warnings, like sort of by listening to a podcast about intuitive eating, body image healing, diet culture, healing, all of those things, like a trigger warning is sort of inherent in listening to this podcast. But certain episodes, I think, can bring up more than others. So when Debbie goes through her story, she does share some explicit like eating disorder behaviors and thoughts. So if that would be triggering for you or feel hard for you today, you can either skip through her story at the beginning or maybe choose another episode for today. Also, a little note, throughout the episode, we talk about the concept of thin privilege and we use the word fat. And specifically, Debbie's new children's book is called Fat and Beautiful, a book about why you can be both. And so just a note there that we are both using the word fat in the reclaimed sense, meaning the objective neutral descriptor, not the derogatory diet culture connotation that the word has sort of become in our society. So important note up front, up top. And we also talk quite a bit about the concept of thin privilege. So that's not really a trigger warning, or there's nothing further to say there other than sometimes the conversation around thin privilege can bring up some funky feelings, whether you're a person who does live in a thin body and you feel like, no, like I don't actually feel thin, like I don't actually resonate with the word thin privilege. Or if you're a person in a fat body and you hear the word thin privilege and you're like, yeah, yeah, must be nice, you're rubbing it in. Like, it's really normal if different thoughts like that come up as you're hearing someone talk about their body privilege or lack of privilege. This is the kind of thing that like isn't spoken about often. So if it brings up complex thoughts for you, that's really normal. Just something to kind of like be aware of going into this episode and listening. Okay, wow, lots of disclaimers before today's episode. Let me read Debbie's bio and then we will dive right into today's episode. Debbie Serafim is a body acceptance coach. Debbie was introduced to the idea of good and bad bodies by her mother, who struggled with an eating disorder at the age of 6. By her tweens, Debbie had also developed one. After years of recovery and boundless personal growth, Debbie now works with women, teens, and tweens to help them make peace with their body and build up their immunity to diet culture. Debbie is about to publish her first children's book, Fat and Beautiful, a book about why you can be both. You'll be able to purchase it on Amazon. Follow along on Debbie's Instagram page for updates and announcements. Welcome to the podcast, Debbie. I'm so excited that you're here today.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. We already started chatting before we hit record and I'm like, all right, let's record. Let's capture all of this so that people can listen in. So I can't wait to chat today. I can't wait to hear more about the children's book you just wrote and more about what you're just sharing. Are you allowed to say that there's going to be a part two or is that not allowed yet?
Yeah, there's already a second. And I didn't even tell you this yet. Like, I already know what the third is. It's a trilogy, if you will, these children's books. So kind of the children's books I could have used when I was a kid. I don't know where I would be if I had had books like this as a child.
And I'd love to kind of get more into your story. So we'll get to the books and all of that stuff. Let's start with your story, with your relationship with food and body, as much as you're comfortable getting into.
Yeah, I am an open book, pun intended. So I am 44 years old, but I was raised by a mom who was 74 and to this day still struggles with an eating disorder. And so I was put on my very first diet at the age of 6. And it was a preventative diet so that I wouldn't undergo, you can't see the air quotes in a podcast, but a preventative diet so that I wouldn't undergo the scrutiny that my mom felt that she had undergone for her body. And it's interesting even now to know at the age of 6, I sort of learned there are good bodies and bad bodies. And if you have a bad body, you should do certain things to ensure that you have a good body. And it's interesting because looking back, my memories of my childhood are of being a fat child. I remember being a fat child. And I remember my mom being a heavy mom. And now as a 44-year-old, I go back and I look at pictures and I was never a fat child. I was never even close to a fat child. My mom was never fat. Never, again, never close to fat. But that was sort of my experience of what bodies were, taking on sort of the belief that, again, that bodies are good or bad and that you can almost feel it in your body if you have a good or bad body. So that by the time I was in high school, I had my very own eating disorder. It was no longer just my mother's. And I started seeing a dietitian and a therapist very early and got rid of a lot of the behaviors. And I remember thinking that that was recovery. And now in retrospect, I see how far from recovery I was. I hated my body and everything, every bite of food I took, every outing that I went to, everything was a calculated decision of if I consume this, how can I burn it off? Or will this be okay? Or even if I have time to burn it off, do I have the mental capacity to take on the guilt for ingesting this food? And so I came out to Los Angeles to be an actress, which was really just sort of, it reinforced that good body, bad body mentality. I actually had a manager who called me one day and she said, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Oh no, what's going on?" And she said, "Well, I just don't know what to do with you because, you know, you're not quite pretty enough to be the pretty girl. So I can't submit you for those roles. And I don't want you to gain 100 pounds and be her best friend. So I think you should get your nose done." It's a horrifying story. I am not proud of the rest of the story, which is that I did end up taking her advice and getting my nose done. There's so much sadness to this story. But one of the saddest things about this story is that I started going on auditions with my nose done. I never had a problem with my nose before, but it really reinforced that there is a correct way to show up in the world, to present. And that if you don't show up that way, there's really not a place for you, right? There is either this stereotypical look or you're the fat, evil sidekick, right? And so this time when I wasn't booking roles, I couldn't blame it on my nose. I just wasn't booking roles. And so I decided to become a personal trainer to pay the bills while I was going out on auditions. And I was like, this is perfect. People are going to just pay me and I can just exercise and be thin for a living. And I had a very different reaction. Honestly, that was sort of the final piece of the puzzle for me because I do live in Los Angeles. It's the world of, you know, beautiful people. And all of these women kept coming to me, all of them asking me to fix their bodies. And I kept having that feeling of like, when are they going to notice I'm the fraud? And that's when I sort of put those pieces of the puzzle together that, oh, wow, the way we feel about our body has nothing to do with the way our body looks. Body image isn't about looks. We think it's about looks, but it's not. And it was at that point that I sort of took a step back because I didn't know how to continue doing what I was doing without propelling the myth that there was a correct way to have a body and that exercise, doing a certain type of exercise or, you know, having a certain relationship with exercise will result in such body. And so that's when I started body acceptance coaching. And it started, you know, with one-on-one coaching. And I was helping individuals. And then I did a workshop, which sort of evolved into now I have a group coaching space. And it's so interesting to see because the group coaching space is so diverse. The youngest in the group is 18. The oldest in the group is about to be 70. There are different sizes. Some people in the group have had eating disorders. Some people have just had disordered eating. It's really sort of like an equalizer of, hey, we all feel really, really shitty. And the reason we feel shitty isn't because of us, right? It's not because of our body. There's big bodies, there's small bodies, all of it. And we all feel the same way. And I think it's a place to sort of come and acknowledge and identify our own body bias and heal from it. You know, I don't think that people in big bodies are treated the same as people in small bodies, but I do think we're all taught to hate our bodies, and that's a real shame. Then I started, you know, I have kids. So I have now a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they were coming home from school saying, so-and-so said, if I eat this, I'll get fat, or you shouldn't eat this, that's not healthy. And we were instilling these ideas of, hey, all food is food, right? All food is good. Not all food is good for all people, right? There are allergies or sensitivities, but all food is good. And bodies come in different shapes and sizes. We have very diverse bodies within my husband's and my family. They're big and small and all of the like. So we really don't know where we're going to end up. But every year since my kids have been in preschool, I've had to send a letter to a teacher sort of saying, hey, this is why we choose not to use this language. Or one day my daughter was ridiculed for not having a healthy enough lunch because I sent her an almond butter and chocolate chip sandwich. And I had to send an email saying, well, you know, this is why we don't label foods as good or bad. And like this was, and she knew it. She even told the class, she's like, no, this is my lunch. Like, it's totally fine. They're like, you're eating it in the wrong order. She's like, I'm eating it in fine order. Anyway, the point is that I was sort of being hit with all these messages that parents get. Plus some of the women that I work with have kids, or I've started to see some of their kids. And I was like, it's so systemic. It's so broken that even as we're teaching in health class about eating disorders, we're not teaching how to have a healthy relationship with your body, because there are all these biases around what healthy means and moralizing it, really, right? Like the moralization of health and wellness, that's diet culture, right? You're a good person if you're healthy. And if you're not healthy, it's definitely your fault. And if you cared enough, you could will yourself to health, right? And so that's where the book kind of came in, is it was never on my list of things to do to write a children's book. But I think in an episode of like fiery anger, I sat down one day and was sort of frustrated and was like, this is just how I want to write it. And this is just how I want it to be. Like, this is the conversation. And poof, like a year and a half later, it's a book. And so the book is called Fat and Beautiful. It's a book about why you can be both. And it is the conversation I wish I had been able to have with my mother when I was young. McKinley, at the opening of the book, she's this gorgeous, very round, like delicious character. She's just like, I just want to hug her and squeeze her. She's so cute. And she's looking at herself in the mirror with adoration in a way that I sometimes feel guilty when I do. And she's looking and she's singing and she's like, I'm fat. And her mom comes in and overhears her. And she's like, oh, sweetie, you're not fat. You're beautiful. And then McKinley explains in a way that I never could why that's not helpful, what that really implies, and then kind of checks her mom's bias. And to this mom's credit, she takes it very, very well. And then I want to point out, I don't want this to be like I'm shitting all over my mother. Like, my mother is just simply a product of the system. And the truth is that if I didn't see the light, I would continue to be like, this goes back way before my mom and her mom and her mom, and just doing the best with the tools that she had. So, but yes.
I want to go back in your story a little bit to the part where you're a personal trainer, which, by the way, I once had someone else on the podcast who went to New York to be an actress and then became a personal trainer in the process for the like exact same reason of like, oh, let me make money. Let me also like work on my body because that will help me with acting. And now she's totally left acting and does anti-diet, intuitive eating, food freedom work full time. So just an interesting parallel there. But I'm curious to hear from you, Debbie. So you're a personal trainer. You're realizing that like a lot of women have this experience of wanting to fix their body, and you're feeling like a fraud of like, wait, like, I also feel like I want to try and manipulate my body size. How do you get from that point to body image coaching, to doing the work that you're doing now? Like, what's that in between? What did that in between period look like?
It's not over. Just to start there, it's not over. It's an ongoing process. It started with, I had one client be like, well, can I send you what I'm eating? And I was like, well, that sounds really dangerous. And she's like, well, can I just send you what I'm eating just so you can tell me if I'm doing anything wrong? So she sent me a list of what she was eating. And I responded with what my dietitian used to do, which is like, oh, look, how are you feeling when you have this? I do that a lot. We do an exercise where I have you write down all of the feelings that you have around the food. And then I ask you questions around those feelings. Where does that come from? We have sort of this like natural conversation with ourselves around food that we don't even notice we're having. Sometimes the guilt just lives in there and we don't really know why. So we started to ask the questions. We started to sort of normalize her relationship with food, or at least identify that the conversation in her head was unique to her, right? That as she was thinking, oh my God, I'm an asshole for eating a cookie, nobody else is looking at her and thinking, oh my God, what an asshole, she's eating a cookie, right? So sort of be able to identify that within ourselves. It started like that. This won't surprise you at all, but the deeper that I get into, why do we feel this way, right? Like, where is this? When we do feel shame, where is that coming from? What is that voice inside of our head telling us when it says, don't eat the cookie? What is it actually afraid will happen, right? And I know that so oftentimes the answer is, well, it's afraid we'll be fat. But what would that mean about us, right? Like getting really curious about it. And so the deeper that I get into this work, this is where it won't surprise you at all, the more of an activist I become, the more I realize, oh shit, these body standards, they have their roots in white supremacy, in the patriarchy. There is so much money invested in making sure we all continue to feel like we are not enough, because there is no money in people liking how they look and just leaving it alone. And so, you know, it's been really interesting to see when it started, it was sort of more like, well, let's try and feel good about ourselves.
Did you know about intuitive eating at that point?
I did know about intuitive eating. I had never done a course with it, but I had sort of, between my dietitian and my own work, I'm not certified in intuitive eating. It's just, I just sort of talked them through some of my process of it, which is definitely in the intuitive eating space. But then, you know, it started with sort of like, let's try and feel better. And as it's evolved, it's sort of been like, no, I don't know that we get to feel better, to be quite honest. Like, I think that this goes so far back and is so deep rooted that more than me trying to convince you to like yourself, my job has been helping you identify all of the anti-fat content and bias that is in the world. That is when you have that feeling of like, oh my God, I look so fat today. I look so gross, right? To know, oh, that's not a real feeling. That's just me bumping up into diet culture, and to sort of be able to identify it.
Or that the feeling is real, but like, is it authentically yours?
Is it authentically yours? But I always like to say, you know, fat's not a feeling. If you look it up in the dictionary, it is a lot of things. It's not a feeling. It's on all living creatures, including plants. And so then when we feel fat, I think we have to get to the question of like, okay, so what's that mean exactly? Because if it is just a thing that lives on bodies, what does fat mean? And you usually come to, well, I'm feeling lazy, or I'm feeling less than, all of these things that we start to associate with fat. And again, as we get curious about it, do you know a fat person who isn't lazy? Well, yeah, I totally know fat people who aren't lazy, but I just don't want people to think I'm lazy. Are you lazy? You know, all of these sort of bigger questions, right, of what it all means. And so, you know, my goal, and especially with kids, I always like to say, look, I would love if there was a switch I could hit, like a magic switch that just said, my kids will never dislike something about their bodies. But my kids are cute as anything right now, when they're not screaming, but I don't know if other people think that they're as cute as I do. And I don't know what their bodies are going to turn into. And even if their bodies like continue to stay with the societal standards, I don't know that they're going to like them all the time, right? There's so many reasons, again, invested in the world for them to pick apart their bodies and find the flaws with them. My goal is not to make you stop seeing things you don't like in your body. My job is to help you recognize that when you have those feelings again are a cultural issue and not something within yourself to be fixed. So if you look at yourself and you're like, I hate my stomach. Cool. You don't have to like your stomach. I have no problem with your stomach. I can't tell you if the rest of the world has problems with your stomach. You'd need to go through and ask everybody in the world, right? But I can tell you that you not liking your stomach doesn't mean that you need to fix that problem or that you need to, you know, restrict or withhold or do extra laps around the field or whatever, right? Like, you're allowed to dislike a part of your body without that dislike being indicative of your body's value, because I don't think we get to like ourselves all the time.
Yeah. I think this is such an important realistic approach to body image, of like having positive body image isn't necessarily, oh my God, I love the way my stomach looks. I love my curves. I love myself. It's a lot less sexy than that. It's can be, I don't like the way my stomach looks, and I know that I'm still valid and worthy. So that those, that kind of like more than one feeling can coexist. Thank you for taking us through some of those more like middle pieces of your story. To get back to the book. So the book is called Fat and Beautiful, a book about
why you can be both.
Yeah. Why you can be both, which I love. And you started to tell us a little bit about the main character and sort of the plot of the book. I'm curious for you, you mentioned in the call we had earlier how you were very aware and intentional that you were someone writing this book with body privilege. So I'm curious how it's been sharing the story being in a thin body.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked the question. You know, it's interesting. It really shows you how my relationship with the word fat in and of itself has changed, because there was a time, even when I started this work, that I was still sort of hesitant to use the word fat, and I wanted to use the word bigger body or larger, right? And again, that's my bias creeping its way in. Just to go on record, I believe you should never comment on someone's body. You never, ever, ever need to comment on someone if they are fat, if they are thin, if they are tall, if they are short, if they are tan, if they're pasty. You don't have to comment. But in avoiding the word fat, we also really, really, really reinforce that fat is bad. And so, you know, I've had my own journey in what I consider to be the fat acceptance, fat liberation movement, and even sort of having some shame around the fact that, and this is such an interesting place to be, because I'd be lying if I said there wasn't still a part of me that wishes I was thinner. That's not a part that I'm proud of. That's not a part that I think, again, it's not indicative of my value or worth. This is the size of my body today. I don't know what the size of my body will be in a year, but this is sort of where I've landed right now. And there's still a piece of me that kind of wishes I was thinner, because it misses the privilege it used to have. Now I'm still thin, but I've noticed the difference in the privilege from where I was as a thinner person to where I am now as a thin person in this body. And also sort of feeling a little nervous, will I be taken seriously in the fat acceptance movement as a person in a thin body? And I think that that really speaks to how much diet culture divides people and others people, because in the anti-diet space, the truth is we're all on the same team. But in the anti-diet space, it does sometimes feel a little bit like thin providers versus fat providers. It doesn't need to. We're on the same team. And I'm not even saying it's versus is the wrong word, because it creates as if there's like a fight against them, which there isn't. But I think that we have to acknowledge that the world treats people in fat bodies very, very differently. That it is more likely that people will buy this book and hear about this book because the author of this book is a thin white woman than if I were fat, or if I, you know, was not privileged in all of the many ways that I am privileged. And that's a problem with the system. Again, that's a problem with the system. And it hurts everybody. It doesn't hurt everybody in the same way, but everybody is impacted by it. And so it's been interesting. I think when I first stepped out with the book and started reaching out to people about the book, again, I was more self-conscious. I sort of led with, okay, I know I'm thin, but I just want you to know. And even watching that relationship change, right? To sort of own more that, like, the book now feels more like its own being. I've collaborated with an incredible illustrator and book designer and all of the things. And so it's almost like when you have a baby, you know, it's like, it's totally yours, but like also not you. Like, this thing's got a life of its own and it's all its own. And so, you know, watching my relationship with it change as I've stepped out and sort of owning the fact that, like, yeah, I'm a thin white woman who wrote a book about this. And yeah, this is how it's impacted me. And this is how I see it. And I'd love to hear more about how it's impacted you. I think everybody's been impacted by anti-fat bias, fat and thin alike. I think we've all been impacted differently.
Absolutely. Like this distinction of we can all have been impacted. And the reality is that for folks with less body privilege, meaning people in fat bodies or slightly larger than the thin ideal, wherever you lay in the spectrum of like the further you get from the ideal societal acceptable body, the less privilege you have. And that can come with real oppression and really difficult barriers to healthcare and different things that folks in smaller bodies don't have. But it doesn't mean that folks in smaller bodies can't struggle with body image. It's just that there's not the added layer of systemic oppression on top of the personal struggle.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. First of all, I think that people in fat bodies are not getting diagnosed with eating disorders because of the fat bias. We believe that eating disorders look a certain way. I also know so many women whose eating disorders are being sort of like cheerleaded on because they're still within what society considers to be the right size. And so it's just like, good for you, keeping it up and all that sort of stuff. So again, it's how it impacts us very differently. And then, you know, I always say privilege is always dependent on other people not having the same privilege that you have. So I think your privilege varies based on where you are, who you're with, and what the circumstances are. I think it's important to recognize that it's always fluid. And yeah, and that also you are not defined by your privilege. I think that thin privilege is a hard thing for people to acknowledge because we live in a culture that tells everyone, hey, the reason that you're thin is because your priorities are in line, you're doing all the right things, and you're a good person. And then someone like me comes in, and I'm like, no, you're just a good person. Like, you could totally do all the other stuff and still be a good person. And it feels a little bit like an attack, right? Like, no, I'm a good person. Let me tell you why. I know why it's hard to sort of take that on. For so much of my life, I did believe I was a good person because I was only eating certain foods and making sure I got to the gym X amount of times a day or a week or whatnot. And then to sort of hear that, almost feeling like that was taken from me, like, oh, I don't get to lean into that to feel like a good person anymore. Now I just get to hold a space for the fact that I'm a good person, whether I feel it or not. That's exhausting.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, the brain likes concrete things. The idea of inherent worth versus having to earn your worth through body size or the things you eat or the way you exercise. I'm curious to hear, Debbie, what do you hope people get from reading this book?
This book is meant to start a conversation. I think even within the anti-diet community, even with people who believe in health at every size and that all bodies are good bodies, there sometimes is like a, well, where do I start? How do I talk about that? How do I bring it up in a way that doesn't continue to sort of stigmatize? You know, there's something when you're talking about biases, you also don't want to teach the bias, right? Like if your child isn't already seeing fat as bad, you don't want to be like, well, some people think fat's bad. And then they're like, some people think fat's bad. This book is meant as a conversation starter because where do you begin, right? And so it's kind of the conversation starts for you. And McKinley talks about all of the reasons that saying you're not fat, you're beautiful isn't helpful. She talks about how the comment in and of itself implies that fat and beautiful can't coexist, whereas fat and beautiful absolutely can coexist. And thin being beautiful doesn't mean fat isn't beautiful, but she also talks about her mom's like, well, I'm just worried about your health. And she's like, well, you can't tell if a person's healthy by the way they look. She really breaks down all of the reasons that it's not a helpful comment. And then in the back of the book are six phrases that I guarantee you have said, because I have said them. I've said every single one of them. And they're very common diet culture phrases. The first being, you're not fat, you're beautiful. And then rephrases, what do you say instead? So there's also, you know, what do you say when your kid is like, how does this outfit look on me? And your response is, oh, well, that's not very flattering on you. How can we change that so that the responsibility no longer goes onto the child to fix their body? Because again, when a child believes that their body is the problem, we enter that dangerous zone of what are they willing to do to rectify the problem? And that can be restriction, that can be eating disorders, and we don't know what size their body is going to be. So we don't know if we're going to catch on to the fact that this child is doing self-harm. So this is meant as a conversation starter. It's totally for kids. It's 100% for kids. And I don't know where I would be if I had had a book like this as a child. But even more than that, it's an eye-opener for parents to sort of say, oh man, I might be passing on some unresolved body issues. One of the biggest things I hear from parents as they talk to me and we work on everything and coaching, parents are like, oh, well, yeah, but I definitely struggle with my body image, but I don't say anything so my kids don't know. And what I have learned is your kids know. Even if they don't know it in a way that they can articulate it. Again, I have visual memories of my mother being fat. And then I look at pictures and she was a different person, right? And this never came from her pulling out diagrams and charts and saying, like, this is what constitutes fat. I was around her enough. And yes, I was dieting. But even if I wasn't dieting, I saw her chase the ideal, again, quote, ideal body and what it was worth and what it meant. Even when she didn't have to say she hated her stomach, I knew she hated her stomach because she wouldn't wear a bikini and she would usually wear a shirt over her bathing suit. And like, even if we were changing in the room together as a little girl, I remember her covering her midsection. You don't have to say what's on your mind. Your kids will figure it out, right? And there's a very decent chance that your kids are going to end up having a body that's similar to yours, because more than food and more than exercise, body types are hereditary, which is both lovely and also fuck, right? So all of the above. Yeah, that was a very long-winded answer.
Yeah, it sounds like that it's a conversation starter and that it gives people something that you didn't have growing up, which is this other perspective and this normalization of all bodies are good bodies, all bodies look different in a really digestible way for mainly the kids, but also the parents. They're the ones reading it to the child. Yeah, and those phrases in the back and the reframe sound really powerful and just like useful, tangible tools. Are there any other body image tips you have in terms of how parents can support kids in having a healthy body image besides like the things they say and like you mentioned, kind of like the parents working on their own body image because the kids always know?
There's a few things. I don't think we can sort of completely shield our kids from the toxic messaging. I think our job is to learn how to identify it and then to teach our kids how to identify it. So the first thing that I would say is if you see someone fat shaming. And fat shaming can be, oh my God, that person is so fat. But it can also be, wow, you're getting a lot of food. That's you're hungry, right? There's so many different ways to fat shame. And if you as a parent notice the fat shaming, you don't have to necessarily call the person out or make a scene about it. By the way, it might not be in person. It could be in a movie or a book or any of those things, right? But again, to get curious about it, wow, what did you think of that interaction? What did you think when Becky said, man, Carl, you're fat? What do you think that was about? What do you think was her point in saying that? What do you think she wanted to do? And is it true? Is it nice? Is it all of these things, right? Just so that they can start to identify that fat bias and that these anti-fat messages, they're not just true, right? These are biases that people are adding to the conversation. So my daughter, when she was learning to read, she would read out loud to me for her reading homework, because that way, if she got stuck on a word, I could help. And she was reading a Ramona Quimby. Do you remember Ramona Quimby? Am I like totally dating myself with how old I am with Ramona Quimby?
I don't.
Okay. I am 44 years old, people. I am 44 years old. I remember reading Ramona Quimby. I don't remember this part of the book. She was reading it and they got to a dinner scene. And in the book, her sister was skinny, but she was serving gravy and she wasn't taking any chances. So Beavis didn't take the gravy. And Hildy read it. And then after the chapter, I was like, so what do you think? Like, why was Beavis scared of the gravy? And we had a conversation about it, right? And Hildy came to a lot of her own conclusions. Some of them were just like, yeah, I think, you know, I just sort of reminded her a lot of people are scared that a lot of foods are going to do bad things to their body. We're so lucky to know that that's not actually something you have to worry about, right? Like bodies come in different shapes and sizes, but you're going to definitely encounter a lot of people in your life who are going to think that food can do stuff to their body. And that's okay. That doesn't make them a good person or a bad person. We just don't have to be afraid of stuff like that, right? And now she's come to me as she's gotten older. She's reading chapter books and she's no longer reading them out loud. She's an excellent reader. And she's come to me a few times and she's like, I'm pretty sure that this is making fun of a fat person. Can you verify? And so, you know, we've had a conversation. She was reading another book that made a joke about like, this place is so politically correct that people aren't fat, they're just horizontally challenged. And she was like, first she was like, what does politically correct mean? And I explained it to her. And then she was like, that's a dig at fat people then, right? That's like, you can't say that they're fat, you say they're horrid. And I was like, excellent, Hildy, you have learned well. And so go run and frolic. So those are conversations, right? So I think that's the first thing that parents can do is if you see it, don't ignore it. Use it as an opportunity to teach and have a conversation. You might even be surprised. Your child might be able to teach you something about it. We have so much baggage that we come with this fat bias that we've been taught, that they don't have it all yet. And so they may be able to give you some insight into something. If you're not just sort of reciting information at them, if you're asking them questions, they may give you an unusual perspective that you hadn't yet thought of. That's the first thing. And then the second thing that I suggest is diversifying what you look at. Do not put kids on social media just to show them diversity. Keep social media away from kids as long as possible. But we've started to put up body diverse art in our house, making sure we find bodies that are represented of all different sizes and shapes, because it's very easy to find all of the, you know, all of the art you want to put up is a certain aesthetic, to sort of teach our kids to see beauty where we haven't. On my social media feed, I very much diversified it, right? And I don't think that diversifying your social media feed means just different size bodies. I think it means different ages, different genders, different physical abilities. You never know where your body is going to end up. And you want to be able to hold a space for the beauty of it, even if you can't feel it, right? And so just normalizing some of these different body types, but you can do that through books, you can do that through art. Even if you're driving past and there's a whole row of billboards, well, what's cool about these billboards and what's kind of boring? I'm bored that every single billboard, they're all for different things, but they all kind of look exactly the same. Did you notice that all the people in all of those billboards look pretty much the same, even though one is selling food and another is selling pants and another is selling, you know, all of that. And so we can start to teach our kids to see the world through the anti-bias lens, if you will.
I love that. Yeah. So it sounds like the first one is really having those conversations, not ignoring it, reflecting back what they're saying and kind of poking holes and asking questions and starting to get them curious. And then the second one being diversifying their, I don't know, not just media, but like their ideas of the ways different bodies can look. I love the idea of being on the highway, seeing a billboard and being like, what's kind of boring about this billboard? Like just kind of making it into like a fun conversation. These are such great tips, Debbie. Thank you. Two wrap up questions that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast. The first is, what is your biggest diet culture pet peeve?
I don't know. One of my biggest diet culture pet peeves is the normalization of no pain, no gain, or hating something. Like there is sort of this, again, moralization of like, if you hate it, it's probably extra good for you. And that's just so not true in so many ways. I'm gonna say that because that can sort of apply over a bunch of things, food, exercise, clothing, all of the above.
It's normal if you hate it and you're in pain. Yeah.
The normalization of that.
So we talk about how if we're not dieting, we're listening to our body, listening to our body's cues, listening to our intuition. And I've gotten really curious about the word intuition, because I feel like it's such a loaded word that we throw around, but like rarely define. So I like asking guests, what does intuition mean to you and how do you experience it?
So this actually, it's going to take us back to part of what my journey is or has been, because I think, again, we're oftentimes thrown like, just listen to your body. And your body is simultaneously telling you it's too tired to go work out, but then you're also feeling so guilty for not working out that you make yourself do it anyway. And is that considered listening to your body? Because you definitely have a conversation going on in your head. So one could say that's listening to your body, right? I think intuition is the innate ability to know what it is our body needs. And it's And I think only babies have it. Like when babies are born, they know they cry when they need a diaper change. They cry when they need comfort. They have no problem identifying, oh, this needs tending to, or this needs tending to. They lack the skills to potentially tell you what it is that needs tending to, but babies know. And then very, very early on, and I'm saying very, very early on because it starts in like toddlerdom, we start to teach our kids, no, 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 you don't want that. You want something else. And so I think part of why feeding yourself is so hard and part of what the work I do with people is teaching them how to have a conversation with themselves. Because I think intuition, your body might want two different things at the same time and they might conflict each other. Like your body might really feel good if you went for a run, but also you need a nap. And how do you know which one you need in that moment? And so I think that there is sort of a myth that intuition means you're always going to know exactly what you want. And it's always going to be really, really clear. And that's not true. I do think your body can want conflicting things. I think intuition is trusting yourself enough to know that there's no getting wrong. If your body wants two things, if you want to go for a run and you also want to take a nap, that one of those isn't the right answer and one of those isn't the wrong answer, right? And there might be certain days where you're like, no, you know what? Today I'm going to go for a run. I can do it. Today I'm going to go for a run and I think I'll feel better for it later. And then there might be other days where you're like, no, today I'm definitely not going for a run. Today I am committing to closing my eyes. And that one isn't right. You're not good for doing one time or bad for doing one the other time. So I think, again, intuition is the ability to have that conversation with yourself, figure out what your body needs and how to answer those needs to the best of your ability in that moment. And I also don't think that all needs can be met all the time. So dispelling that myth as well, that if you get it right, you'll just know because you'll feel good all the time and it's black and white. Do I overcomplicate things?
No, I love this. I love that answer and the example of wanting to go for a run and wanting to take a nap and how you can't pick the wrong thing. Intuition is just like connecting with kind of that conversation of like, what might it be? And it's impossible to get it wrong. I love that answer. I think it's a very self-compassionate approach and we love self-compassion, of course. Is there anything we miss? Is there anything else in your heart that you're hoping to share with the people?
Oh gosh. I always like to say, I say this a lot in my community, as much as diet culture is the moralization of self-care and creates the myth that if you're doing it correctly, you'll look a certain way, I do think that in the recovery world, there is an ability to moralize recovery. And then I think you jeopardize your recovery. I think that part of what helps us get to the point of recovering, you know, is to be able to say, oh, wow, these things that I was doing, these that I believed were making me a good person, this restriction or this extra exercise, those aren't making me a good person. And so then the flip side goes, so now I'm going to be a good person and now I'm going to recover. And the truth is, again, that you are a good person. The truth is you're a good person, whether you recover or not. And I don't say that to encourage you not to recover, but to give you permission to let your recovery be your own. This far in, look, I wrote a children's book. I've written the second and the third, right? And I still have days where I wake up and I'm like, I hate what I see. I hate what I see. I hate what I see. How can I say I do this, right? And you're allowed to have those feelings because in recovery, there's room for all the feelings. There's room for grief. There's room for sadness. There's room for longing for a body that you used to have. There's space to mourn the dream of the body that you're giving up on, right? There's space for all of that. And so I think we oftentimes moralize recovery. And in doing so, we limit our recovery to only being recovered if our recovery presents a certain way. And when we're in that black and white thinking, it's so easy to then, if we're having a bad day and we're saying, well, I'm already feeling like shit and I already suck at recovery, so I might as well just skip lunch, right? And it's just like, it is that moralizing your recovery is dangerous and we all do it a little bit. So again, to hold that space with compassion, that's something we talk about a lot in my community because recovery is complicated, super complicated. So that would be, I think, if I leave you with no other thought, let it be that. And also order Fat and Beautiful, a book about why you can be both on Amazon.
Thank you for adding that. Yeah. So where can people find you to learn more about your work?
I'm very, very active on Instagram. sometimes I'm a little bit embarrassed about how active I am on Instagram, but I am very, very active on Instagram. I'm a little too old to be this active, but I'm this active on Instagram. I spend a lot of time there. That is at body_acceptance_coach. I do a weekly meal support with another Debbie that's how we actually connected. We get together every single Wednesday. We are two Debbies of two different ages at two different stages in our recovery. And we talk about how fucking complicated it can be to feed yourself in a world that tells you that there is a correct way to eat.
And that Debbie, just to say that Debbie Lesko has also been on the podcast. So we can link to her episode in the show notes. She has a wonderful, inspiring story as well.
She's amazing. Yes. Yeah. And so she actually even came out to my house for Thanksgiving. We've become friends through Instagram, and now we are very special friends in real life. And so I spend a lot of time on Instagram. You can also check out my website, thebodyacceptancecoach.com. And then Fat and Beautiful, a book about why you can be both, will be available on Amazon March 3rd. So get your own copy there. And yeah.
I have my copy pre-ordered. It's coming to me. I can't wait to have it in my office.
I know. I'm so excited.
Yay. Well, congrats. It's such a huge deal. And it's such a important thing that we need in this world, more exposure, more opportunities to start those conversations at younger ages. Thank you so much, Debbie. I so loved having you on.
This was so fun. Yeah, this was great. I had a really good time.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Shoulders Down. If you enjoyed the episode, if it inspired you, or if you learned something, consider sharing it with someone to help spread the anti-diet message. A special thanks to Softer Sounds for producing the podcast and making these conversations sound as beautiful as they feel. For more intuitive eating and body image support, visit leahkernrd.com and check out the blog and our free resources. To stay in tune with me and what's happening in my business and personal life, subscribe to my newsletter at leahkernrd.com/newsletter. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.